We have so far talked about the insights from the study of non-ordinary states of consciousness into a wide variety of problems treated by psychiatrists, such as various psychoneuroses, psychosomatic disorders, and sexual dysfunctions. And we have talked about somehow the implications of these new insights for treatment of these disorders. But by far the most interesting insights from the study of non-ordinary states are related to the most serious disorders, the most serious conditions that we refer to in traditional psychiatry as psychotic. This is a very mysterious category of disorders for which we really don't have any adequate explanation. These disorders usually lead to psychiatric hospitalization, sometimes for many years. According to some statistics, every other bed in the United States is occupied by a psychotic patient. So those are chronic conditions very frequently that require decades of treatment, mostly by pharmacological agents. And they also lead to lifetime labels for these patients. Even if they are not involved in long-term hospitalization, they carry the label as a result of some episode that they had in the past. In current psychiatry, we have two different approaches to the understanding of these conditions. And I should emphasize that we'll be talking about disorders which are called functional. There is a significant subcategory of these psychotic disorders where we know actually the medical background, the causes of these disorders, and those are called organic. For example, states that can be explained as a result of degeneration in the cerebral cortex or some vascular disorders or infections and so on, tumors. Those will be referred to as organic psychosis. So we'll be now looking at those where basically we don't have any medical findings that would account for these disorders. And we have two different approaches. Really, a minority of psychiatrists are trying to give some psychological interpretations of these states. And the current mainstream psychological theory is limited to postnatal biographies. So in this context, there are attempts to understand functional psychosis as regression to a very early oral period of the libidinal development in the Freudian sense, and also disturbances of the relationship between the child and the mother, this very, very early stage of life. Now, this is not a very convincing explanation because it doesn't account for some very, very significant aspects of these states. For example, some extremely intense emotions that we find in psychotic patients. For example, paralyzing terror or profound despair, consuming guilt, murderous aggression. It also doesn't explain the extremely rich and complex spectrum of the experiences that these patients are having. For example, experiences of death and rebirth, experiences of destruction and recreation of the world, encounter with various mythological beings like demons and deities, past life experiences which take these patients to other centuries, other countries, very intricate metaphysical speculations that these patients often have, and experiences of mystical states, cosmic unity, oneness with the universe. So both the intensity of the emotions and also this rich, unusual content of these experiences, it's very, very difficult to relate to a situation of a hungry or a lonely infant, some of the disturbances during this early oral period. Now, for this reason, most of traditional psychiatrists see these conditions as organic, caused by some kind of unknown brain pathology or maybe pathology in other parts of the body that indirectly influence the brain. So the idea here is that although we don't know any kind of organic explanation at this time, if we continue our research, that sometime in the future we'll be able to explain them as medical problems. Now again, even here, it's very, very implausible to imagine that some kind of biochemical process or some physiological process could influence the brain and create these extremely complex stories and visions and metaphysical speculations that we find in these patients. So in a way, neither the psychological interpretations available in traditional psychiatry nor the assumption that some kind of unknown pathological process of a biological nature is involved give us very convincing and very satisfactory explanations for these conditions that we call psychotic. If we now apply the insights from the study of non-ordinary states, we get some completely new possibilities in both understanding and treating these disorders. We talked earlier about this large cartography of the psyche that emerged out of this work, where we don't have just postnatal biography, but we have the perinatal dimension, and we have this vast dimension that we now call transpersonal. Now, from this perspective, the content of the so-called psychotic experience is actually drawn from the psyche as such. Of course, psyche is understood in a much, much larger context, in the sense of the Jungian anima mundi, for example. So when we have a conceptual framework that includes birth, the trauma of birth, we can understand some of the powerful emotions that I was talking about. The tremendous fear of death, the sense that the whole world is being destroyed, powerful feelings of aggression and so on, but also the rich content of these experiences, which can be coming from the collective unconscious, both in the historical sense and the archetypal sense. So in this kind of new understanding, the problem is not to explain the content of these experiences that simply is coming from the psyche as such. What we have to explain somehow is actually the trigger, which is why for certain people the deeper dimensions, the deeper levels of the unconscious emerged without any known reason in the middle of everyday life, whereas other people have to take a catalyzing drug like LSD or have to do half an hour of faster breathing, as it is in the holotropic breathwork, or have to participate in a shamanic ritual. So basically, when we work with the holotropic breathwork, we see daily the kinds of experiences that these patients experience as part of their episodes. For example, we very frequently see people reliving births, having experiences of psycho-spiritual death rebirths, having past life experiences, having archetypal experiences. And this happens to a group of people who are not normally considered to be psychiatric patients. There are people who come to workshops or people in our training. So at a certain point it became very difficult for us to see these states as being states of serious psychopathology if the same kind of experiences can be induced by something as simple as accelerated breathing and music and a certain kind of body work. So we coined for these states the name spiritual emergency or psychospiritual crisis. That term spiritual emergency is a play on words. There's a certain sort of ambiguity in that term. Emergency in English means crisis. We talk about the medical emergency, about the emergency room and so on. But the original Latin word emergere means emerging. So the term also indicates the possibility of rising somehow to a higher level of understanding or a higher level of functioning. So we talk about spiritual emergence and spiritual emergency. Now this has very profound implications for therapy, because as we talked about it earlier, the manifestation of the symptoms in these states would be seen basically as an attempt of the organism at healing, at transformation, spiritual opening, very much in the sense of the Jungian individuation process. So if we have this kind of understanding, the last thing that we would do would be to use some kind of method of suppressing the symptoms. We would want to draw the symptoms out. We would encourage the patients to fully experience what is emerging, sort of guiding them somehow to the resolution and integration of these states. Now, the people who are in these states, they need different degrees of care. One of the major problems that these people have is the fact that in our culture and in current psychiatry, these states are seen as pathological, as manifestations of mental disease. So these people who have these states would feel isolated, frightened, they have a fear of insanity and so on. So if this is a milder form, what is frequently enough is just contact with a person who has a deeper understanding, who is willing to listen, give people encouragement and support. If it's a condition that's more intense, we need to create a special situation in which we do some experiential work. And in many instances, just providing this kind of opportunity for people where they can really go deeply into the experience, express the emotions, express the physical states, that in itself can somehow clear the rest of their life, so that instead of these problems happening all the time, they would be experienced in a full form in these experiential sessions and make somehow the situation more tolerable for the rest of the day. But then there are extreme cases of psycho-spiritual crisis where these people need a 24-hour support system. And that is a major, major problem in this area, because we really have very, very few places where people could come and not be given tranquilizers, be surrounded by people who understand these conditions and who are willing to support and guide these people for the time of the duration of the crisis. The obvious question that very frequently emerges when we talk about these conditions as spiritual emergencies is the problem of differential diagnosis. How can you tell spiritual emergency from a psychotic episode? And this is very difficult to do. Now, the reason for this is that the psychotic states themselves are not well medically defined. We talk about them loosely as mental diseases, and we talk about people who have these conditions as psychiatric patients. But at the same time, we don't have a clear medical definition. We don't have laboratory tests somehow that would make it very clear which condition we are dealing with. What we are trying to do is to somehow define the aspects or the characteristics of these conditions that would make these people good candidates for an alternative approach. Now, the first of such characteristics would be the nature of the symptoms, the content of the symptoms. We can say the phenomenology of that state. When we, for example, see that the person who comes to us has spontaneous experiences which are identical with or similar to those that we see daily in average people during the holotropic breathwork, it would be very difficult for us to see them as signs of serious psychopathology, particularly because we know that these experiences, when they occur during holotropic breathwork, can actually be healing and transformative and even evolutionary. The other thing that we are very interested in is the attitude of the person to these experiences, the extent to which they are actually owning it as an inner process, and the extent to which they use the mechanism of projection, where they sort of blame this condition on something on the outside. Generally, people who use a lot of projection have to be considered very poor candidates for this work, which is primarily those people who have paranoid states with sort of persecutory ideas, where they have unusual experiences and would attribute it to some kind of evil influence of their neighbor or the Ku Klux Klan or the Freemasons or some other underground organization and so on. And they have not the least sense or insight that this is an inner process. We are also very interested in the style with which they report these experiences. So somebody who would be considered a good candidate for experiential work would be telling us very wild stories, but in a very articulate way, in a very similar way. For example, a person who just had an experience with a high dose of LSD, they would be telling us very wild stories, but at the same time in a quite comprehensive and logical way. This very likely is a good candidate. If we say, you know, this is a psycho-spiritual crisis and there's a possibility of doing some inner work, you are in a very difficult stage of a process that could be healing and transformative, that person usually would embrace that kind of suggestion. Now, one thing that we have tried to do is to create some kind of a classification, diagnostic categories of spiritual emergencies. And we found out very quickly that it's not easy. And the reason for this is that these kinds of psycho-spiritual crises are really exteriorization of some unconscious material, of some kind of deep unconscious gestalts. And of course, the psyche does not have any compartments in it, so we cannot expect that we would get some kind of clean diagnostic categories of these states. But what we found out is that very frequently we see a certain specific combination or constellation of symptoms which make it possible by and large to define certain main types of psycho-spiritual crisis. So I'll just say a few words about that. One type of spiritual emergency would be something that's very similar to what the anthropologist described as the shamanic crisis, or sometimes they talk about shamanic illness. Now, this relates to the situation in cultures that have the institution of shamanism, where it is well known that for many shamans, the shamanic career begins with a spontaneous visionary state, or spontaneous non-ordinary state of consciousness, in which they kind of withdraw from everyday reality and they have an inner experience of traveling into the underworld and being exposed to various serious ordeals, being attacked by demons, by evil entities, and actually ending up dead and dismembered. And after this sense of annihilation, they have the feeling of getting new flesh, new blood, new eyes, basically being reborn, resurrected. And what follows then is a kind of experience of magic flight, which might involve an experience of transformation into a solar bird, like an eagle or thunderbird or condor or falcon, or the experience of being carried by the solar bird into the solar realm, to the cosmic sun. In some other cultures, it could be climbing on the world tree or on a pole, or climbing on a rainbow and reaching the celestial realms. And typically in this process, there's also a sense of making deep connection to animals, both actually existing animals and also kind of archetypal animals, power animals, as it is called in the shamanic lore. Also connection with forces of nature. And then powerful insights into energetic underpinning of various disorders, how blockages of energy can cause diseases and disorders, and how one can work with energies. So it's like a crash course in healing. Now, when this kind of experience is well integrated, then the person becomes a healer, becomes a priest, becomes a leader of his or her people. So it's a very, very interesting model for spiritual emergencies, because it shows that many of these kinds of conditions can have a very positive result. What is well known about shamans is that very frequently in this kind of episode, they heal themselves before they start healing others. So we read about shamans that they are wounded healers. Now, when they do the work with their people, then they specifically again use non-ordinary states of consciousness. When they do the healing, they either go themselves into a non-ordinary state or induce a non-ordinary state in the client, or both the shaman and the client would go into a non-ordinary state. In some cultures, there's also group healing happening, like among the Kalahari Bushmen. There is a healing trance dance where they dance through the night, and that activates a certain energy, not that different from what's described in India as Kundalini energy. That energy is passed from person to person, and we see powerful healing occurring. So although, you know, in our culture we don't have the institution of shamanism, if you study people in spiritual emergencies, you'll find out that many of them would have experiences of this kind. The second very characteristic type of spiritual emergency is one that is very similar to what's described in ancient Indian scriptures as awakening of Kundalini, or the serpent power. Now, in the Indian scriptures, Kundalini is seen as the creative energy of the universe. That is also its specific representation in the sacral area, in the human body, in the subtle, in the energy body, and is there in a kind of a dormant form, is usually represented as the male organ, the lingam, and serpent that's sort of coiled 3.5 times around the lingam in the area of the first chakra of the base or root chakra. Now, according to the Indian tradition, this latent dormant energy can be awakened either by what's called Shaktipat, by some intervention of a Kundalini guru, by touch, by thought, by look, or by some specific practice, spiritual practice. Or it can also be activated by things like delivery of a child, a powerful sexual experience, or in many instances the trigger is not known. In India, this is seen as energy which is healing, potentially healing, transformative, evolutionary. When it is activated, it's called Shakti. It kind of rises in the body through the conduits of psychic energy and through the energy centers called chakras, 7 of them in the body. And as it rises, it clears various traumatic memories and it heals traumas. And as this is happening, powerful waves of emotions can be emerging, powerful physical states, for example, of shaking and so on. These are called kriyas. And this can also be accompanied by visions of light, by visions of deities. And it's a process of powerful spiritual opening. It is seen in principle as being benevolent and healing, although in many instances it can produce problems. In some extremes, particularly when the person doesn't accept it and cooperate with this energy, it can lead to disease, to mental disease, or even death, according to the scriptures. It's a very, very, very powerful and potentially very, very healing, benevolent condition. Unfortunately, many, many people who have these experiences and go to the wrong people get tranquilizing medication or some other suppressive intervention. The third type that we described actually comes from the work of John Perry, who is a Jungian psychiatrist, and he refers to this as the renewal process. This is the most intense, the most profound form of psychospiritual crisis that definitely would be labeled as a serious psychosis by a traditional psychiatrist. What happens here is that the person in this process goes into a very deep regression that goes all the way to what Perry referred to as the central archetype, which is basically the Jungian concept of the self, sort of deep into the collective unconscious. The person in this form of crisis would have the feeling of being in the middle of some kind of a major cosmic combat, a battle between the forces of darkness and the forces of light. They would have the experience of dying or visiting the afterworld, frequently powerful experiences of death and spiritual rebirth. A thing that happens very frequently is reversal of polarities. For example, male clients would experience themselves as women, and women would experience themselves as men. There's typically also an experience of what Jungians called hieros gamos, which is sacred marriage, which could be experienced as the union of the sun and the moon, or the kind of archetypal king and queen. The people would see themselves as being exalted in some kind of very specific cosmic role. There is the theme of the birth of the divine child, where men more frequently experience themselves as being born as a divine child, whereas women more frequently experience themselves as pregnant with some special child like a messiah and sort of giving birth to the divine child. Then after a certain time of these kinds of experiences, the process reaches this central archetype, which is usually experienced as some kind of radiant sphere of light or a jewel, a pearl, and so on. And then from there, the personality is kind of rebuilt. The person is slowly returning into everyday reality. According to John Perry, many of the patients start spontaneously drawing mandalas that combine circles and squares. It's a quadrature of the circle, which is to be seen as the process of grounding, bringing the transcendental symbolized by the circle to the earth, which is symbolized by the square. And then in time, the patient recognizes that this was not a battle involving the whole universe, but that this was their kind of an inner process of inner transformation, and they managed to integrate it and actually benefit from it tremendously. John Perry sees actually the pre-episode state as being the pathological state of kind of impoverishment as a result of some traumatic past, and the actual episode is seen as a major transformative and healing process. Another typical form of spiritual emergency is one that's associated with the emergence of a karmic pattern, of a karmic memory, where the person can have various disconnected visions, strange physical sensations, episodes of fear or waves of aggression and so on, and doesn't know what is happening until finally the whole gestalt emerges and they start experiencing themselves in another century and usually another culture in some kind of intense situations. They see connection between that situation, that present lifetime. They sometimes recognize that the protagonists in that past life situation are actually persons who are present in their current life. And when they complete that experience, again, this can be healing for some serious emotional and psychosomatic problems. It's a very, very important category of experiences with tremendous healing potential. Another type that we identified has to do with encountering spirit guides and the phenomenon of channeling. An example of that is Jung himself, who described particularly one figure like that, whom he called Philemon. He had a lot of interactions with this inner figure, and he drew in his red book an image of Philemon. He was absolutely clear that Philemon was kind of separate from his ordinary self. He could, for example, ask questions and Philemon would answer them. Jung actually credited Philemon with a lot of the psychological insights that he had. The next one that we describe is crisis of psychic opening, where what's happening is that the person goes into a state which is characterized by a lot of ESP phenomena. They experience suddenly telepathic flashes, they become aware of what other people are thinking or feeling, they know what's coming, they have precognitive experiences, and then particularly experience usually a whole series of synchronicities where somehow their dreams or their visions or other kinds of inner states suddenly form meaningful gestalts with things that are happening in the external reality around them. And sometimes these synchronicities can be very uplifting, where they have a sense they are getting sort of higher guidance. Sometimes they could be very oppressive and lead to states of anxiety. That phenomenon of synchronicity is something that's extremely important, extremely interesting. Again, it's connected with the person of Carl Gustav Jung, who first observed this phenomenon. The most famous example is when he was working with a client and they were analyzing a dream in which the center focus was on the Egyptian scarab. And the patient was very resistant to the kind of a transpersonal approach that Jung had. And suddenly, as she was resisting, something hit the window, and Jung went to the window, and there was a gold chafer beetle, a very, very rare specimen in that area, the closest thing that one can have to scarab in Europe. And he showed the beetle to the patient, and that had such tremendous impact on her that she kind of opened up. So again, this is something that's very, very common in people going through psycho-spiritual crisis, that the principle of causality is replaced frequently in their life by these synchronistic phenomena. And it's particularly frequent in these people who undergo the crisis of psychic opening with a lot of other psychic phenomena. One very important category that deserves special attention is the near-death experience. The reason why it is particularly important is that frequently happens to people who have absolutely no interest in spirituality, who are sort of skeptics, materialists, and so on, fully involved in practical life. For example, it could be a president of a large corporation who is jogging and has a heart attack, and within a few seconds is catapulted into this transpersonal world of, you know, experiencing light, kind of the being of light, experiencing divine judgment, encountering some spiritual beings and so on, and then coming back into ordinary reality and having absolutely no conceptual framework for it. Another important category of spiritual emergency are possession states. It's the encounter with the demonic archetype, and the demonic archetype, of course, is the mirror image of the divine. And also, if this state is successfully completed, it frequently leads to powerful positive spiritual opening. So it's a situation where the person in everyday life has a sense of presence of dark alien energy within their system that causes all kinds of problems, uncomfortable feelings, emotions, but also can lead to impulses to various forms of self-destructive, antisocial behavior, alcoholism, addiction, dangerous sexuality, and so on. This kind of situation where there is just the general awareness of this evil energy being present can actually culminate into a state where this energy takes over and the person starts expressing it, goes into sort of facial expressions which are demonic. Voice can be changed, the expression in the eyes can be changed, there could be contortions, clawing and so on, projectile vomiting, so that the full expression of that archetype can very much look like exorcism. For some people this can emerge spontaneously in everyday life. For others it would happen if they are involved in some kind of experiential therapy. We have seen those states in psychedelic sessions. We have seen them in holotropic sessions. We have also seen them in people in spiritual emergency with whom we worked. We could also include the very interesting phenomenon of UFO abduction, because it has very definite spiritual connections. Keith Thompson wrote a very interesting paper, which was published in our book on spiritual emergency, comparing somehow the experiences that people have in connection with UFO abductions with rites of passage of different cultures. That those people go very frequently through some extremely painful experiences that ultimately are transforming. And again, people who have these experiences usually undergo tremendous crises, because traditionally, you know, these states would be seen as indications of mental illness, as hallucinations, although they have very, very many aspects which make them kind of very, very interesting, that represent a challenge to the kind of traditional understanding, to our concept of reality, and certainly require attention and systematic research. What is very interesting is that also alcoholism and addiction could be in this context considered to be spiritual crises, spiritual emergencies. We have done some systematic work with people who are alcoholics and addicts. We had one large study at the Spring Grove State Hospital in the Maryland Psychiatric Research Center, which was a study of 140 alcoholics taken from the alcoholic rehabilitation unit, you know, very, very difficult cases, what would be called skid row alcoholic in sort of popular parlance. And we had a study of 33 hard drug addicts, all taken from prison where they were serving sentence because of prostitution or pushing drugs or because they committed some crimes
to get the money to support their habit. Now, what we found out is that behind the craving for alcohol or for drugs was really deep spiritual craving. Actually, these were the two categories of patients which had the highest incidence of transcendental experiences. And they would typically tell us when they had the mystical experiences that this is what they really wanted. They didn't want alcohol, they didn't want heroin, they actually wanted this spiritual experience, but they somehow didn't know how to get there. And when they experienced alcohol or heroin, it somehow seemed to them that they were on the right track. So there is an experiential similarity between heroin, alcohol, and the transcendental experience, in that the experiences with alcohol and heroin are like a kind of a caricature, in a sense, of a transcendental state. But there's enough of an overlap that people who get involved with alcohol or heroin believe that they are on the right track. And they continue, and they, of course, don't get there unless they, you know, completely ruin themselves and hit the bottom. And in the process, they would then cause themselves physical damage, social damage, and so on. So what we see is that the only programs that really are effective for alcoholism and drug addiction are those that include the spiritual dimension, particularly the 12-step programs, the programs that are just limited to psychological and biological treatment generally are not very successful. We have some very interesting experiences both with psychedelics and with the holotropic breathwork. With psychedelics, we had very, very good results in both of these studies. For example, 50% of these alcoholic patients who are really sort of skid row patients managed to be successfully rehabilitated according to the judgment of an independent team who evaluated the results. It sort of went down a little. This was at 6 months, and it went down a little at the year follow-up and then 18 months follow-up. But still, it was, you know, quite impressive result. In a group of hard drug addicts, the success rate was 33%, one-third of the patients remained sober for 6 months. Now, this was a category of patients where usually if they were released from prison or from a treatment facility, you know, within a very short time, 90% of them would be back on the street using. So these were the main types. Obviously, this is not a kind of exhaustive description. I'm sure that as we continue, some additional types would be identified. And also, they are not clean types. There's obviously some overlap, but we feel there's justification of talking in terms of types or categories of spiritual emergency. Now, when we had enough experience with these situations, Christina in 1980 decided to create what she called the Spiritual Emergence Network. We sort of became aware of the fact that there are many people who are going through these kinds of experiences, but we were also meeting many professionals, psychiatrists, psychologists, and psychotherapists who were developing this new understanding. They're not seeing these conditions as just mental diseases, but as crises of transformation. And so it became clear that there was a need to bring these people together, people who needed help and people who were capable of giving help. So she started the Spiritual Emergence Network. At this time, it's basically independent. It is located in Santa Cruz. Now, there are two problems in the whole spiritual emergence network. One of them is that somehow the demand for help is still much, much bigger than the resources of professionals who are able and willing to offer alternative help. The other, and that's the major problem, is the fact that there are no 24-hour centers for those who are undergoing really intense crisis that cannot be handled on an outpatient basis. This is a situation where these people need to be under constant supervision and getting support that would continue for a period of days or even weeks. I would like to end this with a case history that both Christina and I were involved in, of a woman whom we called in our book Karen. which I think is going to give a very good picture of what a spiritual emergency is and also what the potential is. Before I start talking about this person, I'd like to emphasize that this was an extreme form of spiritual crisis that really bordered on what would be considered psychotic. She was willing and able to cooperate with us much of the time, but there were episodes where we simply had to wait, where she was not willing to cooperate. She was 29 years old at the time when she had this crisis, very beautiful. She was a masseuse at Esalen, where we lived at the time. And at one point she started having powerful, non-ordinary experiences. Now the question that emerged was, should she be hospitalized? Now Esalen is a community where many people are involved in alternative therapies, and people have done a lot of work on themselves, and they're not particularly sympathetic as far as suppressive pharmacological treatment is concerned. And she also was very much loved by the community. And so we decided, instead of hospitalizing her, to provide 24-hour support for her, in that we would take shifts, usually two people at a time, being with her for several hours. And Christine and I spent about 3 hours a day with her for the duration of this episode, which was about 3 weeks. An important thing here was to provide somehow continuity. So we had a notebook in which all the people doing the shifts would give a brief description of what transpired during their shift, and also, and this was very important, wrote down whether she ate and how much she ate and whether she drank. One of the problems in these kinds of prolonged, powerful emotional states is that the people who are involved in this can forget about eating and drinking, and they can get kind of emaciated, they can get dehydrated. So we wanted to make sure that she gets enough liquids and vitamins and nourishment. Now, during these 3 weeks, we basically did not see anything that we did not know from our work with holotropic breathwork. So, for example, she had a very difficult childhood. When she was 3 years old, she was alone with her mother when she committed suicide. So she found her mother dead and was there for several hours before some other people came. Then her father remarried, and she had a stepmother who was very abusive, including physical abuse. So part of her experiences dealt with these traumatic experiences. She was reliving things from her infancy and childhood and was sort of working them through. She had also powerful experiences of her own birth that alternated with experiences of delivering. She had some difficult experiences at the time when she delivered her daughter. This was also part of the traumatic experiences that she worked on in this state. The episode where she experienced the punishment, the physical punishment from her stepmother, opened up into past life experiences where she identified with a black African slave who was being punished, severely physically punished with a whip and so on. Then there was an entire episode in which she experienced activation of Kundalini and the Kundalini energy flowing up her body and lightening the chakras. And at this point she had an insight that sexuality is really a powerful spiritual force and has tremendous spiritual potential. And she believed that she was the first person who became aware of this, and she wanted to go and tell everybody that sexuality was a sacred force and that people shouldn't just screw around and kind of squander this energy. At other times, she went through powerful, violent impulses where she identified with a predatory animal. Then these episodes kind of deepened into identification with a demonic archetype, where a lot of the energy was expressed sort of in obscenities and kind of a outpouring of aggressive comments about people around. At certain times she was extremely psychic. For example, when people were coming for the shift and they talked on the way, it turned out that when they walked in, she knew what they were talking about, was able to continue on that subject with them. This was also the time when Reagan and Gorbachev are meeting in Reykjavik, and there were a lot of important things happening in the world. She didn't read, of course, a newspaper. She didn't have television in the room. And yet she somehow got connected with these political events and was able to talk about them. So these kinds of experiences went for a while, and then after about 2 weeks, they started turning more and more positive, where she at times felt deep union with the environment, with nature, with the ocean. She also started experiencing a powerful source of energy inside of herself, which turned out very much like the symbols for the self, with capital S, that Jung and Jungians are talking about. It was very much like the central archetype in the work of John Perry. She talked about this center as a precious pearl, as a sort of divine core of her personality. And then somehow from connecting with this source, she started rebuilding her personality and connecting to the environment. After about 3 weeks, these experiences became sort of weaker and weaker, and finally she was able to ground them. As a result of these experiences, she was really transformed. Before this episode, she was a very shy and very inhibited person. During these 3 weeks, there was a very powerful, expressive energy that came through. A lot of it very creative. She was singing, she was making poems, and some of it kind of stayed with her. She was much more self-assertive, much more outgoing, much more active and full of initiative after this process. She didn't think about this as being an episode of mental disease. When we talked about what happened in the past, her usual expression was, "I cracked my mirror." So for her, this was a really healing, transformative episode, and it turned out to be also extremely interesting and rewarding experience for everybody who was involved in this process. So in this way, after years of experience with people in spiritual emergency, we came to the conclusion that there's really good reason to sort out a very significant subgroup of the conditions that are today diagnosed and treated as psychosis, as episodes of mental disease, and see them as crises of spiritual opening, crises of transformation, states that if they are understood properly and supported in the right way, can actually lead to healing of many emotional and psychosomatic problems. They can lead to positive personality transformation and even to consciousness evolution.
This concludes tape 3. Our program continues with tape 4.